Good morning, everyone. Got 1 minute left of morning, so we just snuck that in there. Oh, thank you. Brilliant. Cool. I'm wondering what your initial reaction is when you see these two words on the screen, altars and covenants. I'll confess, these words to me, I think it's a childhood leftover of seeing these words, and these were like big, scary, confusing Bible words. That was the category I put them in. So I know they have meaning, but they're a bit intense. They're old. They're really old school. I'm not sure what they mean. And to be honest, even to this day when I see those words, probably my initial reaction is, oh, old Bible words. I'm curious what your reaction is when you see it. I asked someone before church, older and wiser than myself, what he thought when he saw them. And he had the complete opposite reaction. He said, altars. Altars are beautiful. Altars are things you build to remember something beautiful and sacred and important that's happened. And covenants, well, God is a covenant God. And isn't that a beautiful thing? And just the complete opposite reaction to me, which I thought was beautiful. So maybe your reaction is somewhere in between the two, or maybe you're at one end or the other, or maybe you know these words far better than I ever will, or maybe you know nothing about these words, and all of that is okay. We use a lot of words in church, or at least our church does. Maybe some churches are different, but our church uses a lot of words, and we tend to use a lot of words over and over again, and sometimes they gain meaning for us, and sometimes they lose meaning for us when we use them over and over again. But why do we use words over and over again? Why do we tell these ancient stories over and over again? Really, why do we do it?
To impress upon your mind.
To impress upon your mind, yep. I like that. To impress something upon your mind. To etch it there. And why do we do that? Why do we tell these stories that have ancient words that we don't use in our day-to-day language necessarily? We do it because these ancient words and these ancient stories have powerful truth in them. Truth about the reality of who we are, the reality of who we were created by, and the reality of the community that we're made to live within. That's why we tell these stories over and over again. It's to impress upon our minds and our hearts the truth. The truth is not necessarily what we live and come face to face with day to day and what we struggle with and what weighs us down. Or maybe the truth is not even necessarily the things that we think make us happy or the things that we think make us free. The truth, the deep truth, speaks to us from a lot of these old stories, and that's why we tell them over and over again. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to look at two old stories, an ancient story about covenant and an ancient story about an altar. And we're going to look at these stories and a little bit about how those stories develop and grow. We can watch that through the Bible, but we can feel that in our lives as well. Now, by no means is this going to be the one and only message you'll ever hear on Sermons and Covenants. There's so much left out of this, and I hope that as you listen, it makes you think of other things you've learned. And I hope that as you listen, it makes you think of questions of stuff that I didn't get to. Stuff that didn't make sense, and I hope that you will go away and seek those answers. And I know we've also had a few other messages recently on these topics, so the hope is that they come together. So, firstly, a quick question for you before we dig into the stories. What do you do when you want to make a really solemn promise, a really firm commitment in the world? Yes? You might shake hands on it. That's a very gentlemanly way to seal a promise, I think. I like that. Do you think that maybe shaking one person's hand on a promise would make you feel more confident than shaking another person's hand on a promise? Maybe, yeah. Maybe in the business world, your professional lives, what might we do to seal a promise? Yes.
Sign a contract,
absolutely. Sign here, 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 and here. Oops, you've given away the family home. Hopefully not. Hopefully you've gained a family home. Absolutely. We have a whole industry, several industries, in fact, to do with people helping you to figure out how to sign the contracts. When Matt and I got married, we made a really solemn promise. And we stood up in front of a bunch of people and we said it publicly. We didn't shake hands, we sealed it with a kiss. Don't know how legal that is. But we also signed a bunch of documents that now, even if we wanted to get out of it, which I don't, I love you, would be very hard to get out of. That's the idea, is you're bound. You're bound to this promise or person or commitment that you've made. But I'm curious, what did people do in ancient times? What did the ancient peoples, the oldest, earliest humans, what did they do when they wanted to seal a promise or a commitment? Before there were courts and lawyers and judges and legal systems that developed out of our need to figure out how to make commitments to each other, what did people do in the very earliest times to seal something in a really solemn way? Oh, I've got a hand. Oh, blood. Blood. We're on the right track. I like it. Yep. Absolutely. And when someone says a blood promise, or it's a bit like, ooh, that's a bit intense. Ooh, I don't know. So it's to us, to our modern ears, that sounds a bit primitive, doesn't it? Primal, ancient, really old school, just like those words. All right, keep that question in mind, and we're going to read a story. If you like reading along, you can go to Genesis 12. We are going way back. Genesis 12, we see the start of the story of Abraham. Or confusingly, he's called Abram at the start of the story, and then later God says, now you're Abraham. So it'll be Abram for a bit, and then it'll be Abraham, same person. The Lord had said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So Abram went as the Lord had told him. The Lord had said to Abram. Kind of just dive right in there and then you get onto the good stuff where God's talking about blessings and promises and all that. But if we take a step back, we can miss how incredible that statement is. The Lord had said to Abram. How did the earliest humans perceive the world around them? It was flat, okay? It was flat. Good things happened, bad things happened. Why? And as humans, we know we have a desperate need to figure things out. So the earliest humans would have asked this question too. Why? Why does good stuff happen? Why do bad things happen? Why do my crops grow one year and not the next? Why did that child live and that child die? The earliest people saw things happening around them that mattered to them, that impacted their lives, and they wanted to put meaning into that. So what did they do? They envisioned that there must be a greater being or greater beings. There must be something in control far above where we live, and that something or someone's controls the wind and the rain and whether we get sick or whether we get better, all the things that really matter to us as humans. They perceived that the earth was controlled by bigger forces that were distant, yeah? Unknowable. Could never figure them out. And quite possibly cruel. There's a lot of hard stuff that happens in our lives. So maybe these distant beings didn't really care that much about what happened to us because stuff just happened all the time. So the earliest people had this concept of gods that somehow controlled the earth, and the gods were distant and unknowable and quite possibly not that nice. And then we read a story where the Lord says something to Abram. And that shatters everything that the earliest people would have known. The gods didn't speak to people. The gods didn't care about people. And yet, really matter-of-factly, right at the start of the Bible in Genesis 12, you see, the Lord had said to Abram, like it was no big deal. So this is where we start to see that this old story of covenant, and this is part of that story, is actually an ancient story with a twist. The story's ancient to us, but at the time it was absolutely mind-blowing because just the idea that a god would make contact with a human. There's no equivalent in modern times. Like if aliens made contact with us, You know, that changes every paradigm. It changes everything you think you know about the world. And that's where we start, is the Lord said to Abram. So, if you want to turn to Genesis 15, we're going to read a bit of a longer story. Same main character, though. Main characters. We've got God and Abram. And Genesis 15, the Lord's covenant with Abram. So after this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward. By the way, if you don't like reading, there are some visual prompts you can amuse yourself with instead. But Abram said, oh, Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless? One of my slaves will inherit my estate at this point. Abram said, you've given no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir. And then the Lord said to him, no, that man won't be your heir. A son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir. He took him outside and said, look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. And he said to him, so shall your offspring be. Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord credited it to him as his righteousness. The Lord said, I am your Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans, ancient places, to give you this land to take possession of it. But Abram said, oh, Lord, how will I know that I gain possession of it? That's a pretty big promise, God. The Lord said to him, bring me a heifer, a goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon. So Abram brought all these to him and cut them in two and arranged the halves opposite each other. The birds he didn't cut in half. And birds of prey came down to feast on the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. And as the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. And then the Lord said to him, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation that they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. And when the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking firepot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces of the animals. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, to your descendants, I will give this land. And he tells Abram from where to where exactly this land will be given. So, what on earth is going on? There's speaking gods, and there's a guy called Abram. There's promises and slaughtered animals and dream sequences and smoking fire pots. This is where we get back to the question at the start, is in ancient times when you wanted to make a really serious and binding promise or agreement with someone, what did you do? Well, you didn't sign a contract, that's for sure. You made a covenant. And how did you do that? Well, often a covenant would be made solemn by slaughtering an animal. And then you would pull the two pieces of the animal apart, and both the parties would walk through the middle of the pieces. And as they did so, they would say something like, may the same be done to me if I do not keep this oath and pledge, which is very Game of Thrones. And essentially it's saying, you know, if I don't uphold my end of the bargain, I'll end up like this animal. Also, probably where the phrase to cut a deal comes from. Interesting. So this is the making of a covenant, right? But not between two humans, between God and one of his children, Abram. Abram would have understood as he was making this sacrifice that, oh, this looks like a covenant agreement. And while this seems totally weird and barbaric and ancient to us at the time, that was a relatively common way of making a serious agreement with someone else. So, weird story for us, but a relatively normal story maybe for Abram. He thinks he knows what's going to happen. What happens then? Well, the sun sets and Abram has a fantastic dream sequence, and the voice of God makes this promise to him says what's going to happen to these ancestors, to these descendants that he's promised to Abram, that they're going to suffer a lot, but that God will always provide for them, and that in the end they will have a land of their own and many possessions. It's a promise that is made. And then, in the darkness, there's this vision of a smoking fire pot. I'm kind of envisioning like a billy sort of kettle that's somehow on fire. It's got a smoking eucalyptus branch sticking out of it. Appears and floats down between the aisle of the broken animals that have been slaughtered. So what are we seeing here? Well, this is God's presence. We see God, his presence symbolized by fire and smoke throughout the Bible, don't we? Particularly in a few Old Testament stories. Moses and the burning bush. It's far more mysterious and beautiful to picture God as a smoking, you know, symbol, perhaps rather than a Lego man in a white coat sort of floating around. Anyway, this representation of God makes the covenant promise according to the customs of the time. He walks between the halves of the animal and he promises to Abram that he will look after his children, that they will be safe, that they will have a home, and that they will be blessed. But what would have been weird about this for Abram or for the people at the time? What didn't happen in that story? Abram didn't walk through the middle of the carcasses and make the promise back. So this is a story of a God who spoke to humanity, to a particular human, who then covenanted with a human and made the whole covenant himself. So in effect, this is God saying, Abram, I promise this to you and to your children and your whole family and the people to come. And even if you mess up so bad, even if you fail every part of this that I ask you to do, I will uphold this covenant. I promise you this. This is a really old story, and it's really unfamiliar. And when we pull it apart, there's so much richness and beauty in it. But it's completely foreign to us to start with. And the funny thing is that for the earliest people who might have heard this story being retold, perhaps Abram's children and descendants, as they tried to come to grips with where their people had come from and who was this God that their parents tried to teach them about, this would have been one of the stories that was told to try to explain who this God was and why they believed what they believed and why they hoped what they hoped. Because Abram's descendants would go on to go through a lot of awful stuff and be enslaved and be in exile, but they held on to this promise that God had made in such a dramatic fashion. And that would have been something that they noticed about this story was, wow, this is fully God's gift and promise to us. He didn't actually ask anything in return. So we respond by faith and trust and hope. So that's a story of covenant. Probably one you've heard before. Maybe some new details, maybe not. It's pretty exciting when you get down into it. I feel like they need massive explainer for every sort of chapter and verse in Genesis, because there's so much in there that makes no sense. And yet at the core of it, there's just a real simple truth that God is a covenant God, as Phil prayed. What does that mean? It means that he gives and he promises to us. Not that he asks and requires and binds us and tells us off, but that he gives and he promises to us. All right, if covenants aren't your thing, we're going to do an altar story now, so don't stress. Maybe you liked the word altar better. I'm going to start with this question for you to consider, which is, what do you do when you want to impress the gods? I keep having flashbacks of a really old movie my dad used to love called The Gods Must Be Crazy. Don't know if anyone else here has seen it. Really, probably doesn't translate too well into modern PC times, but it's essentially a tribe of people somewhere in Africa, and I think an empty Coke bottle. A guy in a plane chucks it out the window and it lands in the middle of this community who have no contact with the world. They live in a tribal way and they have their own understanding of why there's rain and sun and the gods. And this Coke bottle lands in the middle of their community and it throws in the air everything they think they know about everything. And there's a line in there somewhere like, oh, the gods must be crazy. What's going on? I have no idea how that ties into this. We'll find some kind of link later. I just really kept thinking of that thing. Okay, we're going to read another story. We're still in Genesis. If you'd like to go to Genesis 22, if you'd like to read along, otherwise I'll do my best to bring it to life verbally. And don't worry, we have pictures again. So sometime later, God tested Abraham. He's Abraham now, Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham, here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, named Isaac, and go to this particular region and sacrifice your son there as a burnt offering on a mountain that I will show you." Okay, already this story is very weird. Yep, all right. So early the next day, Abraham gets up and loads his donkey. He sets off with two of his servants and his son Isaac. And when he cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the particular place that God had told him. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. And he said to the servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." So Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, "Father, yes, my son, the fire and wood are here, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Kid's clever. Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. And when they reached the place that God had told him about, Abraham built an altar and arranged the wood on it. And he bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then he reached out his hand and took his knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." And Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. And he went over to the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." The angel of the Lord called out to Abraham for a second time and said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through their offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." So this story is like super uncomfortable for us, but it's okay. We're going to unpack it. We'll just sit in the uncomfortability for a minute and talk for a moment about altars. A lot of this message came about because Spud was researching a little bit about altars. We're singing this new song and it's great, but what are we actually singing? Good to know. So some things I learned about altars, and I've got some bad pronunciation coming up, so enjoy. Altars are ancient things. There's an old Hebrew word, mizbeah, which means to slaughter. Okay? There's also an old Greek word, thusiasterion, which means place of sacrifice. The Israelites in exile, so Abraham's descendants, many, many years from now, they carry an altar with them as the place that they worship God, to symbolize that God is with them. And when they settle in their promised land, the land that God promises so many years before, the first thing they do is they build a great temple, which has two altars in it. Altars can also be places to mark where something important has happened. And we see that in the story of Noah, he builds an altar when they finally find land again after being on the ark. Abraham builds several altars through his story. He builds one right at the start to sort of remember the place where he chose to leave everything he knew and follow this God who had spoken to him. So we have this idea of altars being really ancient structures of sacrifice and slaughter, essentially. And also this ancient idea of altars as commemorative places, places of remembrance of really important things. But altars are also really modern, everyday structures in a lot of traditions. Many Christian churches, as Matt said earlier, have a physical altar at the front of their church. Different styles, different placements, but the idea that that's the place where the communion bread and wine or the Eucharist is made holy. And so when you come to the altar, you're coming to remember that supreme sacrifice that was made. Hold that thought. So, what's happening in this ancient altar story? Well, remember we were talking about the angry, vengeful, distant gods that people might have imagined to try to explain the world that they were experiencing around them. What do you think you'd do to try to impress those gods or get on the right side of them? Sorry? Gifts? Yeah, that's how I impress people. I don't know about you guys. Had a new colleague at work start a couple of months ago, and he would bring food everywhere. Malteser Monday, fromage Friday. And he just brought food everywhere. And I asked him after a while, I'm like, what? Like, this is great, but why? And he said, it's the easiest way to get people to like you. And when they like you, they'll do things for you. They'll push that project through marketing. They'll give you the okay to send out that email. Lovely person, very switched on. And this was what the ancient people thought too, right? They didn't have Maltesers, but they thought maybe if I give the gods a good enough present, I'll prove to them that I love them and I respect them and they will be favourable to me. So maybe if I want a really good harvest this year, I'll take some of what I've got and I'll offer it to the gods and they'll see that I love them. People would give offerings. And what do you think they noticed about when they gave offerings to these gods that they imagined? Well, sometimes it would probably appear to work, right? You give an offering asking for rain and then the next day you might have a whole week of rain. And you think, great. But sometimes you'd probably give offerings and it wouldn't appear to work, right? You'd have a really terrible harvest. There'd be a massive plague and all your animals would die or someone that you loved didn't get better, they got sicker. And so what do you think people did to try to compensate for this? Yeah, Jason. Ooh, okay. Yep, the offerings would get bigger. Oh, yes. Yep, yep. You guys have already hit the nail on the head of where this good intention but wrong thinking is heading. If you imagine that what you give to the gods influences how they treat you, you're going to keep giving them more and more. So it'll be wheat, then it might be a small animal, then it might be your prized cow, and then it might be several of your prized cows, and then it might be your child. Because what could be more precious than that? And that's where the ancient humans ended up. That child sacrifice and human sacrifice was not as horrific as we now hear it to be, but a natural step in the way that they were trying to deal with the world around them, because they didn't yet know the truth of a loving God. So, for Abraham to hear the command that God says, go and take your son and sacrifice to him, it's not as jarring as it sounds to us when we read this story. In that time and place, Abraham would know that maybe this was a thing that the gods did. You know, he's been walking with this God for a while, but this is how the gods work, right? They demand things from you, and this God has asked. Of course, Abraham has a choice, and we know that in this story, his faithfulness and his trust in God is emphasized. But it wasn't as weird a request as it sounds, which is why we then read that Abraham packs up his donkey and takes the servants and heads off with his son. And in fact, he gets all the way to nearly sacrificing him when something happens. So again, for us, really weird story. For the ancient people, kind of not as weird a story, like, yep, okay, these things happen, but we quickly see that this story becomes very weird for them as well, don't we? It doesn't end the way that you would think it would end if you believe in gods that demand super sacrifice. There are a couple of clues in here that maybe this story is not going to that inevitable ending. Abraham says to his servants, you guys stay here and me and the boy are going to worship and then we will come back to you. We will come back to you. Okay. If you're in a time and a culture where you've got firewood and knife, you're going to make an offering and you've got no cow but you've got a son, it's probably pretty obvious to most of the players what's going to happen is one of you is going to come back. But Abraham says, we will come back. So for whatever reason, Abraham is like, I'm not buying the old story. Something different is going to happen. And then Isaac asks his father, well, where's the lamb to be sacrificed? And Abraham says, God will provide it. I've always read that, to be honest, for most of my life, as Abraham's like trying to shield his son from the awful truth of what's going to happen. But when you look at it in the context of Abraham kind of giving this clue that maybe he thinks something different will happen, maybe that's actually a statement of the strength of his faith, that he's chosen to believe that this God will provide. So at the climax of the story, we've got Abraham ready to sacrifice his son as he's been commanded to do. But he's stopped by an angel that speaks with the voice of the Lord. And God does provide an animal to be sacrificed, a great big ram that's conveniently stuck in some bushes nearby. And that sacrifice is given instead. God didn't actually demand that terrible, huge, enormous sacrifice from Abraham. All he really wanted was Abraham's faith and trust, which incredibly we see that he displays in this story. Our God is the God who provides. People often ask of this story. I don't know if you've ever read this story with friends who aren't from a Christian faith, or maybe you've just read it yourself and asked this question, but people say, what kind of a God would ask you to sacrifice your son? What kind of a God? And the answer? Not this God. Not this God. This is not a story about a God who wants us to make terrible sacrifices for him to prove that we love him and that we are worthy of him. This is a story of a God who provides for us. Of a God who's completely throwing the old stories and the old way of things out the window. And he's bringing us into a new way of understanding the world and him and our place within it with each other. At the very end of that passage as well, we see something really interesting. The angel kind of goes on and says this whole extra little ad lib bit. Not only has God provided for Abraham, but there's a reference to Abraham's children and descendants being a blessing to the whole rest of the world. And though Abraham would have had no way to know it at that point, we see, reading back from now, we see God hinting at his ultimate plan. That his blessing wouldn't just be for one guy named Abraham or for that one guy's descendants, but for all of humanity, for the whole world. So, we've got some stories about covenants and some stories about altars, and these are by no means the only stories involving these things and ideas in the Bible, but we've read these particular ones today. And it helps maybe shed some light on the depth and the richness in these words and what they're actually pointing to, the bigger story that they're actually part of. But where do these stories go? Because covenants are very old things, but they don't live in the past. And altars are also very old things, but also part of the here and now. So where does the covenant story go? Well, we can trace this covenant story, if you love your Old Testament, you can trace it all through the dealings that God has with his people. You can trace it particularly to Moses. You probably think of Moses when you hear covenant. And God makes a covenant with the people of Israel through Moses. Those people, of course, being the descendants of Abraham. And God makes a covenant with those people about how to live with one another. And God promises to love and protect those people. And they don't cut an animal in half, I believe, to seal that covenant. But there is some kind of sprinkling of blood. So blood is still involved in the way that these ancient people were making these covenants. Now, what happened to that covenant and how did people end up perceiving it and living it out? Well, in their desire to uphold their end of the bargain, God's people made lots and lots of rules and standards. And they believed that keeping those stringently was the best way to prove that they were keeping their end of the bargain with God. And it ended up being kind of the focal point of the whole way of life for the Jewish people was how well you could uphold these standards. Which weirdly is making me think of the ancient people who thought that if they could just give bigger and bigger gifts, God might be happy with them. Now we have a slightly less ancient people thinking if they could just do better and better at keeping the rules, God might really love them. The old covenant eventually became hard and sad and slightly exhausting work, and the humans were never good at it, or never good enough at it. So, we have a new covenant, don't we? I think we've heard that phrase before, a new covenant. With the coming of Jesus, God reveals a new covenant. And that covenant is that he promises to rescue us from sin, from all the heavy stuff that weighs us down in life, and that actually we get to live for eternity with God as fully human as we were made to be. And, incredibly, that nothing we do or don't do can break that covenant, this new covenant. This is a covenant of relationship based on faith and trust rather than law and deeds, the work that we do. So how did God make this new covenant? Because, I mean, we've seen when God covenants with his people, he does things that are according maybe to the tradition of the time in some way. You know, with Abraham, he slaughtered some animals and God himself took that covenant walk through the middle. With Moses, there was a meeting and a sprinkling of blood to seal a covenant. How does God create or bring into force the new covenant? Well, if you want a story, you can read in Luke 22. And at the Last Supper, Jesus, who is perfectly human and perfectly God, says to his disciples, after breaking some bread and passing it around, he takes some wine and he says, This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. So God makes a new covenant with us through Jesus. One last thing about this new covenant before I forget, because I feel like, again, language is tripping us up. We've got an old covenant, we've got a new covenant. But how old do you think the new covenant is? Because new makes it sound like maybe God kind of, it was like a Windows update. God is like, oh, I'll fix the bugs on that one, we'll do a new, oh, this is what I really wanted. Okay, kind of replaces or modifies. In fact, this new covenant that we talk about, which is really grace, isn't it? Our understanding of grace and acceptance. This new covenant is the oldest covenant. If you want to talk about stories, this is the oldest story that ever was. And if you want to read why I'm saying this, I won't go through it all, but go to Ephesians. Read the start of Ephesians where it says, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus, who has blessed us in the heavenly realms. For he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. In love, he predestined us for adoption to sonship through Jesus." And you read in Ephesians 3, according to his eternal purpose that he accomplished in Jesus Christ, his son. This new covenant is actually a really old covenant, and it's the covenant that God had planned for us all along. The covenant story doesn't actually start with Abraham and go to Moses and get to Jesus. The covenant story starts with God in eternity. That was always his plan. And that's the covenant story that we are a part of. Take that in for a second. God's eternal plan to love us and have us with him. That's the covenant story we're a part of. So that's kind of a new covenant story. What's a new altar story? Is there a new altar story? Now I'm looking at the word altar too much and it's getting weird in my head. Like if you say bathtub too many times, it gets weird. Altar. Sorry to the altars in the crowd. We love you. So God's people worshipped at altars for thousands of years, and in some way we came probably a little bit obsessed by them in the old order of things. We're still trying to impress God by how much we could sacrifice on the altar. And worse still, I think maybe as we get to more modern times and modern humans, we started building altars again to other gods, to the god of money, the god of power, maybe even the god of self. And when we stop trusting God at his altar, we seek to kind of back ourselves up with the other altars that we may create in our lives. We put our trust in other places. But, of course, if you have a new covenant story, you must have a new altar story to go with it. And we do. We have a final altar. The cross on which God provided a perfect sacrifice for us, to set all things right forever, to give a gift so great that it would seal the deal that God loves us eternally and that we're accepted and that we belong. And with that one perfect sacrifice, he washed away the need for any old covenant and the need for any future sacrifice, because what could be more perfect or powerful than the sacrifice Jesus made? So today, how does this story work itself out in our lives? That's a big question. I'm not going to answer it. But if we try to translate these ancient stories of covenant and altar into what it means when we bump around together and we meet on Saturdays and we support each other in the week and we go through life in places that we'd never say the words altar or covenant, how does this story actually exist in our lives today? Because we don't go to altars and offer lambs, do we? We don't make covenants with God or even a lot of the time with each other. We do more modern stuff than that. But this story is incredibly present in our lives today, because if instead of taking a sacrifice to an altar, we come to a table together, don't we? And we drink wine and we eat bread in remembrance of Jesus' sacrifice for us on that final altar, the cross. And then we give thanks and praise to God for his covenant with all of humankind, the promise that we are loved and destined to have life with him forever. So maybe that was just 30 minutes of me telling you really old stories and you're still not really sure why. Or maybe these old stories had a little bit of new life for you, maybe. We tell these stories because they tell us the truth of who our God is. He's not an angry, distant, vengeful God. He's a present, compassionate, loving, covenanting God. And this story tells us truth about who we are in a world where we're told that we are not enough, that we will never be good enough. Maybe in a world where we feel like we don't belong or we're not sure where we're going, the covenant stories and the altar stories remind us that we belong deeply. We were created to belong, that we are enough just as we are because we've been covered by God's sacrifice that he provided, that where we are going is to eternity with our Lord. All right, I think it's time for us to sing again. I'm just going to leave you with a final thought. There was a concept associated with altars that was called high places. And this was really prevalent in early human cultures. And the idea was that if you would build your altar on a mountaintop or the highest place that you could find, that would make your offering more potent, more powerful, more meaningful, because you were closer to the heavens and further away from all the stuff on earth. And this was an idea that really resonated with early people. They thought this was the truth. This was how it was done. But that altar story has no part in our altar story. We don't need to trek to mountaintops and build fancy altars as though it were our own efforts that might impress God. Instead, we're invited to sit at the table with Christ, and we're invited to believe and trust in our acceptance that God has planned for us all along. So, some ancient stories, some ancient words, hopefully full of the encouragement that you are accepted, that you are redeemed, and that you belong.